This is Watchin Lake Bible School 2013. We have our brother Ken Stiles with us. His theme for the week has been Prophecies of the Last Days. The topic for today is a man of sin, a false prophet, and a great whore. The reading was taken from Revelation chapter 16, verses 12 to 21. Brother Ken.
Good morning, everyone. First thing I'd like you to do is remember that subject, because God willing, we'll get to it tomorrow morning. Where are we today? 73, we have a guess. Russia and Iran have developed an alliance. It's not where it's going to be, but it has begun to develop. Homosexuality is beginning to be promoted. It is not where it's going to be in the end. But we're already seeing signs of it. Early stages of the EU are developing. The Russian-Europe alliance is showing signs. All of these were on the outside, remember, in 1950. Vatican's influence is beginning to show. Don't see yet any indication of the Russian, France, and German alliance. Don't see any indication yet of a Vatican-Russian alliance. Christian ecumenism is developing. Violence and immorality are beginning to surge. Israel's wealth is beginning to emerge. There's an Israeli-Jordan alliance. No indication yet that Britain will come out of the EU. That sign has not developed. Russia has virtually no military, and what it has is inept. No indication that Russia and Israel are friends, but there is a strong Tarshish-Israeli alliance. So we have one vote for 1973. Any other votes? 95. We're getting closer. And it's 95 would probably be just as good as the year 2000. So if you're within 10 years, you get the green check mark. But one of the reasons we do this is to recall where these arrows were in 1950. Virtually all of them circled the target. There were a few within it. And the greatest advancement, the greatest movement we'll see is between this morning's target and tomorrow morning's target, because there has been substantial movement in 10 of these arrows, as we'll see in tomorrow morning's class. God is not teasing us with these things. He's saving us. One of the marvels of how God has written Latter-day Prophecy is that He has kept our community on its toes for the last 160 years. That's the marvel of how Bible prophecy has been written. There have been 10 different generations of believers since the days of Brother Thomas in 1870. 10 different generations. Now there are 5 generations here. You've got the babies. You've got those who are 20 years old, those who are 40 years old, those who are 60 years old, and I suspect there's even some here that are close to 80 years old. 5 generations are here. There have been 10 generations since the days of Brother Thomas. And every generation genuinely and justifiably was convinced that they were the generation that we would see the second coming. Each one was eagerly waiting for Jesus to return. God has not been teasing our community. He's not been leading us along or playing upon our ignorance and desire for the kingdom. He's trying to save us. Because in every one of those 10 generations, they have been justifiably looking for the return of Christ based upon the signs that they saw. What would have happened to the early community of believers if God had provided the exact date? And Brother Thomas, in all his studies, had determined by the year 2013, Christ still won't be back. They'll still be waiting for Him. You can see the devastating impact it would have. That's why he doesn't tell us the date. He just gives us the signs. And the beauty of it is a generation looks at the signs and says with certainty, surely if the Pope's power comes to the end in 1870, there it is in Daniel 7. How could he not return when the Pope's power ends? And so an entire generation lived on the edge in full expectation. Exactly where God wants us to live. He has purposely written Latter-day Prophecy to encourage godly living based upon the expectation that is created over Christ's soon return. Hopefully we can see the wisdom of God in being able to record prophecy in this way so that we don't know all the details and we don't know the exact date. But there are distinct markers that indicate we must be at the end time. It isn't just Daniel 7 that talked about the 1260 years. We know that also shows up in Revelation 13. It's the same with 1917. How could you read Jeremiah 30, 31, 32, and 33 and see the Balfour Declaration issued and not believe that Jesus would soon be in the earth? How could you read Ezekiel 38 and then see Israel established in 1948 and not believe that Jesus would soon be in the earth? Or Luke 21 and see Jerusalem captured in 1967 and not conclude that Jesus' return was imminent. This generation will not pass away. So these have been very, very helpful, distinct markers for our community. They have electrified our community, and rightfully so. Prophecy has been written in such a way that Christadelphians for 160 years have genuinely believed with eager expectation that Christ would return in their lifetime. And it's a blessing that they did. Try living with the burden that Christ will not come back for another 200 years. That would destroy the faith of the last generation that God is trying to save. So it's quite marvelous how the Scriptures are written. You know, if you're still not convinced of God's wisdom, contemplate what it would take to write the end of the story and have sufficient markers within the end of the story so that every generation would be genuinely enthused and have it cover a period of 160 years. It's a marvel of how God has written this. And we of all generations who can now look back on the 160 years and see the thrilling prophetic events that have taken place, we should be the most appreciative and the most prepared of all generations. Not an easy task to write 160 years of events and leaving every generation with the eager expectation that Christ might return. When the exposition of Daniel was being revised and reprinted, Brother Thomas had calculated, I think we mentioned, that the 1260 years would end. And he had a conviction based on his study. And his conviction was rooted in God's Word. And he wasn't wrong to have that conviction. He was wrong by 160 years about the return of Christ. But he wasn't wrong to have that conviction. He had collapsed events, as we mentioned, that ought not to be collapsed. God wanted him to have that conviction. And God was not fooling him. God was not teasing him. God was not leading him along. God was saving him. That's how God saves us. The mockers and the scoffers look at this and say it could be another 50 years. The truth of the matter is we don't know. We can hardly believe it could go on another 50 years. But he has provided us the signs that there ought not be any of us that can look at these things and believe we have 10 more years or 5 more years. He wants us to live on the edge. And again, he's doing it to save us. He's doing it to convince us that we need to have our own conviction based upon our own study. You can draw a very short line between today and the second coming of Christ. A very short line. There are no prophecies, as we've said, that still require so much time that they couldn't be fulfilled within that 10-year period between the return of Christ to raise the dead and judge the household and the Battle of Armageddon. It could all be fulfilled within that period of time. We've already passed the point where 10 years is a sufficient period of time for God to finish the prophetic plan. He wants us to have a short line perspective. He doesn't want us to have a long line perspective. That's why he's written prophecy the way he has. He doesn't want us to think in terms of 50 more years or even 20 more years. He wants us to live in high expectation that the end is near. Our past brethren all had this short line perspective. And rightfully so, and it served them well. So the length of time should not cause us to despair or to doubt. It should cause us to marvel that God has written the word in the way he has, that has left every generation prepared. We left off yesterday in Daniel 8. We're hoping to finish up there and cover Daniel 9 and 11 as well, and just briefly introduce Revelation if things go well. We saw how the detail in Daniel 8 of the little horn of the goat prophecy and what it would do in the first century. It would rise up against Israel, and it would destroy the temple, and it would remove the Mosaic order, and it would take away the sacrifices, and it would crucify the Messiah. And we saw that this evidence all points to there can be only one power, one power of the day that equates or fulfills the symbol of the little horn of the goat, and that was the Roman Empire. We also saw how in verses 17 to 19, as with Daniel 2, as with Daniel 7, Daniel 8 is primarily a latter-day vision. Sometimes we spend all of our time explaining the history so that someone will understand the chapter, and we walk away thinking, well, this must be an historical prophecy. That's not the case. We need the history to understand the latter day, but it is clearly a latter-day prophecy. The characteristics of the little horn of the goat, as we looked at yesterday, it's ferocious. It's very destructive. It's very successful in what it does in verse 24. It's conceited and arrogant. He magnifies himself in his heart. He has the gall to stand up against the Lord Jesus Christ. We finish by saying, certainly, these characteristics can apply to those centuries of years in which the little horn of the goat power prevailed. And you can see the evidence of the religious aspect of that power that would rule over this section of the earth. So there is an application of verses 23, 24, and 25 to those centuries. We're not demeaning that in any way, but the focus of chapter 8 is on the latter day. There is a special application to the time of the end, just as we saw in chapter 2 and chapter 7. We'll see it again in chapter 9. We'll see it again in chapter 11. Watch out for the final phase of the little horn goat power, is what God's message to Israel is. In that day, a very destructive, successful, conceited, arrogant ruler will arise and cause mass destruction for Israel. And when he's done inflicting that on Israel, he will turn and stand up against the Lord Jesus Christ himself. It's another example of that wonderful principle of replication. At the time of the end, there will be a latter-day version of the little horn of the goat. It's the final phase, if you like, of the latter horn of the little horn of the goat. It will manifest all the same characteristics, the same spirit as the original little horn of the goat. There will be a dominant power with an overwhelming military. It will rule over the global territory of the full Roman Empire, east and west, because remember, when the Messiah was cut off in the first century and those other things happened, that was not just the eastern end or the eastern section, that was the entire empire. So the ruling power of that little horn of the goat, we can expect to be the full Roman Empire, just as it was in Jesus' day. So there will be the dominant power, the overwhelming military power. It will rule over that territory. It will occupy the Holy Land. It will oppose the Messiah. It will oppress the Jews because of their transgressions. And that all happened in the first century. So in the latter day, there will be a dominant power with an overwhelming military ruling over the same global territory. It will also have a dominant leader, and it will conquer Israel and occupy the Holy Land and oppress the Jews because of their transgressions. And it will oppose the Messiah once again, just as before. Again, that's how God can use the same symbol spread apart by 20 centuries and show us how it all works out in prophecy. It's not the same person that will arise in the latter day. So when we talk about the replication principle, it doesn't mean God will raise someone from the dead. You know, Julius Caesar, don't expect him to walk again on the earth, at least not in that capacity. But it does represent the final phase of this system, a And that's why God uses the same symbol. For a brief time, when the little horn of the goat invades Israel, it will appear to the Jews living in Jerusalem that it is A.D. 70 all over again. And that lovely and wonderful representation and reenactment that we saw last night, that is going to happen again, is the warning of Daniel 8. The Jews will think someone has turned back the clock to the first century because they will be reliving the same devastating events, which is why the Lord Jesus Christ in the Mount Olivet prophecy cites this very thing. It's going to happen soon, he says, and then it's going to happen at the time of the end. Where is he citing from? Where is he quoting from? He's quoting from Daniel 8. There will be a replication of these events at the time of the end, and when they happen, watch out. Watch out if you're living in AD 70, and watch out if you're living at the time of the end, because it will be the same power coming out of the same territory. So there is both a first century and a last century application. But in both cases, it's the invasion of the little horn goat power from Daniel 8. It's also why in the Mount of Olives prophecy, Jesus' second coming is one in which he comes to save Jerusalem, not to destroy it like it happened in AD 70. And it's exactly what Daniel 8 says. Remember, at the end of this 2,300-year period, the final outcome following the devastation is the prince is back in the land and the temple is cleansed and the people are saved and God's truth is restored. It was all done away with for a long period of time, Daniel 8 tells us. But in the time of the end, it will all be restored. Exactly what Daniel 8 says. So you can line up the Mount Olivet prophecy and Daniel 8 side by side. The outcome of the first invasion was the destruction of Jerusalem. The outcome of the second invasion will be the salvation of Israel. Because the final phase, while matching the previous phase from 2,000 years earlier, has a much different outcome. But the marvel is God can use the same symbol to describe the same events. Because the latter day version of this power will match the same characteristics of the former version, we see both powers represented. And when the power is destroyed, Israel then is blessed. Recall, the focus of this prophecy is on Israel and the destructive impact that the little horn of the goat would have on the Jews. Just as it wreaked havoc in the first century, it will wreak havoc in the last century. These are not saints. Take a look at verse 25 when it says, in the time of the end. This is when the prophecy is now having its latter day application. What does it do in verse 25? It shall destroy many. Those are not saints that it is destroying. It doesn't fit with the historical context of the prophecy. The saints are not the ones destroyed just prior to Armageddon. It doesn't fit with the rest of Old Testament prophecy. The saints have been taken away to judgment. The saints weren't destroyed by peaceful means. They were destroyed by persecution, and Daniel 7 identifies the lengthy period of that persecution. Daniel 7 speaks of the Roman Catholic Church making war against the saints. The enemy here destroys Jews. And he destroys them by peace. These are Jews that are slain. And they're slain by the latter-day king of fierce countenance. Prior to his destruction, by Christ and the saints, he will be very successful at killing Jews. That's what Daniel 8 is telling us. That's what Joel 3 told us. That's what Ezekiel 38 told us. That's what Zechariah 12 told us and 13. Very successful at killing Jews. And the means he will use is by peace. And it matches the pseudo-peace that we saw in Ezekiel 38. Israel is going to be fooled, is what Ezekiel tells us, is what Daniel 8 is telling us. They are going to think they're living in a peaceful situation, a peaceful time, a peaceful era. You see, you don't use peace to destroy many unless it isn't a real peace that is in existence. It's a pseudo-peace. Rotherham's translation in verse 25, by their careless security, he will destroy many. And hopefully you can see how that dovetails with the description in Ezekiel 38. The RSV says, without warning, he shall destroy many. The NASB says he will destroy many while they are at ease. So Daniel is warning Israel that they will be living in what they think are peaceful times, only to see many destroyed. In Ezekiel 38, Gog has an evil thought and deceitfully invades an unsuspecting and trusting Israel, who are dwelling in peace without bars and walls and gates, and the outcome is many die. And Daniel 8, the king of fierce countenance, who understands dark sentences, sinister schemes is how the New King James translates that, through his policy, the Hebrew there for policy is through his intelligence, he uses craft, and that's deceit or falsehood. And he's a very intelligent individual, but in a very sinister way, and he deceives people. He calculates his plans and his actions all in advance. And what does he do with all his intelligence and his sinister schemes and his deceit? He kills Jews. That's what he does. So that both Ezekiel 38 and Daniel 8, the chief enemy of Israel, succeeds by craft and it destroys by peace. And it is the Jews who will die. They're called the holy people in verse 24. So it's the same evil invasion by the same evil leader with the same evil plot and intention and the same evil result. And Daniel 8 helps to explain how in Ezekiel 38, Israel is caught off guard because they have been far too trusting of this deceitful little horn of the goat power that arises in the last day. By his deceptive thinking and by his deceptive talk, they will think that all is well. It's a time of peace and safety. But as we know, and what Daniel is warning them, all will not be well. They will be deceived. Daniel's warning will go unheeded and millions will die. And you can see now why in verse 27, Daniel lay sick for many days. It's a terrible prospect. My people are going to be fooled, and as a result, they're going to be annihilated. And it will all happen because of a deceitful, cruel, and conniving, and ruthless man. So that when we see the full picture portrayed in Scripture of this single ruler who will be the arch enemy of Israel, and how he will cause so much suffering for God's people, we can appreciate why God wrote Ezekiel 38, much like he wrote in Daniel 2. God says, I am against you, Gog. I'm coming for you, Gog. And when my son acts in the latter day, it will be against you, Gog. 38 verse 1, and again in 39 verse 1. One brother said there is something intensely personal about these prophecies where God is coming for Gog. And we can see in Daniel 8 why God will hold him personally accountable for having fooled his people and then having put millions to death. This arrogant and destructive leader will be put to death himself in the Battle of Armageddon, which occurs in verse 25. And it's worth having that marked if you don't already, because he will rise up even against the Messiah. So that what becomes evident is that the latter day little horn of the goat is synonymous, you see, with the image of Daniel 2. In Daniel 2, as we saw, the image was the kingdom of men in its totality and its final assault upon God's people. And the prophecy of the little horn of the goat reveals that at the end time there's a single, unified power comprised of many nations, both east and west, including Europe, the Vatican, North Africa, and hostile Arab nations. Everyone and everything that stands in opposition to God is represented in that little horn of the goat prophecy. It is the great adversary of Israel, and it arises for the purpose to make war against Israel. So it's more than just Russia. You know, we need to make sure we're not falling into that trap. The little horn of the goat power is more than just Russia. It will incorporate all of Israel's enemies as they march off to Armageddon. We have a quote. We won't take the time to go through it from Brother Thomas. It's in your notes. And he equates Gog with the little horn of the goat and calls it the Constantinopolitan little horn power of chapter 8. But hopefully we can see now how the vision of Daniel 8 aligns with what we have already learned from the other Old Testament prophecies. Zechariah 13 said two-thirds would die. Daniel 8 says the same thing, only it doesn't give us the number. The cleansing of Daniel 8, because remember, the little horn of the goat prophecy in Daniel 8 is about how long will it be until Israel is cleansed, the temple is restored, and the people once again can walk with God. Well, it's going to be 2,300 years. But at the end of that period of time, the cleansing will take place. And we know what that cleansing looks like and how it was brought about in Zechariah 12 and Zechariah 13. Joel, Micah, and Habakkuk all describe the intense hatred of the Jews. And we see that reaching its fruition in Daniel 8. So that the end of the little horn of the goat matches the end of the image in Daniel 2. There's good reason to say these symbols are describing the same power. Just as the image stood in chapter 2 at verse 31 at the time of the end, so the little horn of the goat stands up in verse 25 of chapter 8. The image represented, as you recall, the seed of the serpent standing in defiance of God. That's what the little horn of the goat represents at the time of the end. The two suffer the exact same fate. They'll both be miraculously destroyed, broken without hand, as verse 25 says. Chapter 2, cut out of a mountain without hand. And it just doesn't mean that the little horn of the goat or the image is destroyed by a miracle, which it is. It's destroyed by divine means. It's also telling us that this power is so enormous that there is no other power on earth that could stop it. That's what by no human hand is telling us. As we saw yesterday, the territory will be massive. The nations that will be aligned will be massive. There will be no power on earth that could stop this fourth beast, this image, this little horn of the goat at the time of the end. But God can, and God will. Daniel 8 also reveals that the image of Daniel 2 is not in some passive state. You know, you draw the image so often and you see the image described so often. You're sitting there with its arms folded, just waiting for the stone to be cut out of the mountain. It is not in a passive state. It's in a very aggressive state. It has invaded Israel. It has taken captives. It has slain millions. That's what the image has done at the time of the end. I realize that's not in Daniel 2, but it's another case where you have to put all the pieces together so that God uses a variety of symbols and titles to portray this same great enemy of Israel in the latter days. While the feet of the fourth beast are occupied in stamping Judah and his allies in the glorious land, the fourth beast power and the little horn of the goat are fitly represented by the image. The little horn of the goat, as Brother Thomas wrote, and Daniel's fourth beast are both representative of the king of fierce countenance of Daniel 8:23, at the time when the commander-in-chief shall break the former in pieces. It's important to recognize that the fourth beast and the little horn of the goat, though descriptive of the same power, are not identical from the standpoint that, recall, the fourth beast lives on after Armageddon. Russia will have been defeated. When we come to Revelation, we'll find that the dragon will be bound up, but the fourth beast will continue to live on. So it's not as if the fourth beast is destroyed in Armageddon. It is not. The dominant power of the little horn of the goat is the eastern leg of the image. It's the Russian power. It's the Gog, who's the head, or the prince of Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal. It will lead the invasion, and then it will be defeated, but the fourth beast will live on to fight a second battle at the end of the 40-year period. So remember how in the latter-day King of the North didn't come into existence until the Confederate Russian power of Gog takes possession of the King of the North territory. And that's the same situation we have here with the little horn of the goat. So that the King of the North doesn't exist right now. And it won't exist until it controls all of that territory. When we say it doesn't exist right now, it's the same way that saying the image of Daniel 2 doesn't exist right now. It's being built. It's about to exist. But until a power arises that occupies all that territory and commands all that an army of the size that it does, we're still waiting for that final stage when the king of the north comes into power. So too with the little horn of the goat. It doesn't yet exist. It will. When Russia assumes control of that territory, the little horn of the goat will come into existence. And then it will take on the name and identity of the little horn of the goat, just like it will take on the name and identity of the king of the north, so that it becomes apparent that the same latter-day power bears multiple titles, and that's a key to understanding these latter-day prophecies, but it's still the same latter-day power, so that the king of the north and Gog and the little horn of the goat, also known as the king of fierce countenance, and the image of Daniel 2 and the beast of Daniel 7, they're all one and the same latter-day power. So what this means is that when Russia and the Confederacy of Nations finally come, then one will be able to say, there is the Gogian host. It fits all the criteria. And another will be able to say, there is the king of the north. It fits all the criteria. And another will be able to say, there is the little horn of the goat. It fits all the criteria, and they will all be right, because it will fit all the criteria. Hopefully, too, you can see that we've waited till the end of chapter 8 to differentiate between the two little horns in Daniel. They are not one and the same, and they ought not to be confused. He uses a little horn, God does, in both prophecies to show this power will start small, but it will grow big. It's true of the religious power in chapter 7. It's true of the political power in chapter 8. They represented two different latter-day powers, closely aligned and sometimes intermingled actions, but they're separate and distinct entities. The little horn of chapter 7 pertains mainly to Europe. The little horn of chapter 8 pertains mainly to the Holy Land. The capital of one is Rome. The capital of the other is Constantinople. The little horn of chapter 7 in Daniel is primarily the papacy. Throughout its existence, it is the saint's enemy. Throughout its existence, which is why Daniel 7 is primarily concerned with the impact of the kingdom of men upon the saints. The little horn of chapter 8 is the Roman Empire, whose origin is much earlier because it grew out of that fourth horn of Alexander's empire. It comes prior to the birth of Christ. The Jews are its principal enemy. What the little horn of Daniel's fourth beast does in chapter 7 to the saints, the little horn of the goat will do to the Jews in chapter 7, the little horn of the goat as the enemy of Jews. It will do that to the Jews. It was the little horn of the goat was the Jews' enemy in Jesus' day. It will be the Jews' enemy at the return of Christ. What we can watch for as a result of knowing the prophecy of Daniel 8. Well, like we saw in Ezekiel 38, we should look for peaceful conditions to develop in Israel, because it is by peace that he will destroy many. We can look for a friendship to develop between Russia and Israel, because that's what happens when you're living in a pseudo-state of peace, when you think you can trust this ruler. Daniel is saying, don't trust him. Habakkuk warned he's going to come in and destroy secretly. He's going to kill the poor secretly. Don't trust him. But they will. There's a picture of President Netanyahu just in February sitting down with President Putin. Let's talk about all this oil and gas now that we can bring out of the Mediterranean Sea. Mr. Putin brings the skills and the ability of the Russian oil and gas industry and could tell Mr. Netanyahu we can bring that oil out of the seabed cheaper and more efficiently than any other country and any other company. And Israel signed an agreement for 20 years in February of this year, and that nation is going to destroy them. But they're going to be fooled. This isn't the only example. Watch the oil and gas industry in Israel, and watch the role that Russia will play. We don't know what will happen tomorrow, but God is giving us an indication that the Israelis are already warming up to the prospect of making money and establishing this friendship. It may even become an alliance. We don't know. The same Gogian Confederacy in Ezekiel 38 foretells that the little horn of the goat will see the uniting of all of Israel's enemies. There will be a ruthless, destructive, successful, arrogant, conceited ruler. And we expect Gog to take Constantinople because that was the capital of the little horn of the goat. That was the capital of the king of the north. So we move now to Daniel chapter 9. The prophecy of the little horn of the goat doesn't end in chapter 8. In fact, the little horn of the goat will now be expanded upon in chapter 9 and in chapter 11. It's not that this prophecy goes away. God will now expand upon what he's already revealed and provide more details. Recall at the end of chapter 8, Daniel didn't fully understand what he had seen. Verse 27 of chapter 8 says that to the effect. Chapter 9 will occur some 15 years later, and there's still an uncertainty. So Daniel is praying for greater insight in respect to this vision. And we pick up in verse 22 and 23 of Daniel 9, and he informed me, this is when Gabriel came to visit Daniel, and talked with me and said, O Daniel, I am now come forth to give thee skill and understanding. At the beginning of thy supplications, the commandment came forth, and I am come to show thee, for thou art greatly beloved. Therefore, understand the matter and consider the vision. And the vision Gabriel refers to here is from chapter 8. It's not as if Gabriel will give him a new vision. He's going to help Daniel understand the events of chapter 8. And he does so by giving him this 70 weeks prophecy. But it's covering the same events. And the proof of that is in chapter 8, verse 11, the temple is destroyed. And in chapter 9, verse 26, the temple is destroyed. There are not two different destructions of the temple. It's one and the same. In both cases, it's the Romans who are doing the destroying. 490 years would pass from the decree to rebuild Jerusalem in the days of Nehemiah to the Messiah's crucifixion. There's several aspects that are listed in the prophecy. We won't go through them other than to note three. First is the link with chapter 8 and verse 24, where the 70 weeks prophecy is dedicated to thy people and thy holy city. Just as chapter 8 pertained to the Jews, the prophecy of the 490 years, applies to the Jews as well. Verse 24 of chapter 9, the phrase to finish the transgression. Remember how we saw in chapter 8, to finish the transgression was a transgression of the Jews when they put the Messiah to death. And when that happened, God said, watch out, there's a little horn of the goat power that's going to come and it's going to cause havoc in Israel. Daniel 9 is talking about the same havoc that will be meted out on Israel when the transgression is finished. 70 weeks are determined upon thy people, in verse 24, and upon the holy city to finish the transgression and to make an end of sins and to make reconciliation for iniquity and to bring in everlasting righteousness and to seal up the vision and the prophecy and to anoint the most holy. So this is the same events in chapter 8 and in chapter 9. The same reference point in chapter 9 that we have back in chapter 8, verse 11. And the 70 weeks prophecy, we know then in verses 26 and 27, go on to describe what we saw last night, the Roman invasion of AD 70, subsequent to the crucifixion. Picking up in verse 26, and after 62 weeks shall Messiah be cut off. There's the cross, but not for himself and the people of the prince. That's the Roman army that would be brought in. Matthew 22, verse 7 talks about it being God's army. It shall come and destroy the city and the sanctuary. See, we're talking about the same events as chapter 8. And the end thereof shall be with a flood, and unto the end of the war desolations are determined. And he, the Messiah, shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week, and in the midst of the week he shall cause the sacrifice and the oblation to cease. And then the prophecy again jumps to AD 70, and for the, or because of the overspreading of abominations, he shall make it desolate. He shall make the temple desolate, even until the consummation. And the prophecy there jumps again to the end time, so that the consummation there is now the latter days. And he says there's going to be the desolation of the temple, and it's going to continue until the end or the consummation. And that determined or that decreed shall be poured out upon the desolator. So this prophecy, in a very short period of time, takes us from the crucifixion of Christ to the invasion of the Romans in AD 70, when the temple is destroyed, until the very end time. So really the only phrase in the chapter that has to deal with latter-day prophecy is what happens at the end of verse 27. In the AV it says the desolate. If you look in the margin it says the desolator. Divine wrath is going to be poured out upon the desolator by God. It's not going to be poured out upon those who have been made desolate. So that in verse 27, we have our third link between Daniel 8 and Daniel 9. It's that phrase, the overspreading of abomination when the temple was defiled by the Romans. So whereas we saw Daniel 8 verse 11 became a reference point for us in verse 24, Daniel 8 verse 13, which speaks of the transgression of desolation, becomes a common reference point for verse 27. This is where Jesus is quoting in the Mount Olivet prophecy about the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel. He could have continued by saying, spoken of by the prophet Daniel in chapter 9 at verse 27. That's what Jesus was saying in Matthew 24, verse 15. He was warning of the impending Roman invasion. The desolator will bring war. He will cause desolation. He will destroy the city and the sanctuary and the temple. So you see, Daniel 9 is telling the same story as Daniel 8 in terms of what would happen in the first century, of how the Romans would come and destroy Jerusalem and destroy the temple and bring in the same abomination as Daniel 8 mentions, and it would leave Israel desolate and devastated. And then there would be a long, long period of time. Daniel 8 says it, Daniel 9 says it. A long period of time from between the Messiah being cut off until the consummation in verse 27, until the end time, until that time determined by God, when he would pour out his judgments upon the desolator of God's people. So the desolator of verse 27 would be destroyed because of the destruction he had brought upon God's people. And that the destruction against the desolator and his ability to continue until the end time matches what we saw in Daniel 8. They are one and the same power, the desolator and the little horn of the goat. The Messiah would be cut off, the Romans would destroy the city, the temple would be desolate, but finally in the end, the desolator himself, the little horn of the goat himself, would be defeated. Again, we have some quotations in the handout to validate the thoughts that we have in terms of these are the same points of understanding. There's no other way to understand Daniel 9. You can't come to Daniel 9 and say at the very end time there will be a desolator who ties all the way back to the first century and the crucifixion of Christ and the desolation of the temple. You cannot have that fail to tie to the Roman Empire. And you cannot have it fail to tie to the little horn of the goat or the fourth beast, because they're all coming out of that same time, that same territory. Now, when we jump to Daniel 11, hopefully by now you've observed that there's a latter-day application to all of Daniel's visions and prophecies. It's revealing how, though any particular prophecy may have its origin in ancient history, it also has a latter-day application because that symbol will run right through time. And it will pass through different phases, but there is a special application of each of the symbols, each of the prophecies, each of the visions. We saw that with the metals in chapter 2 and the beasts of chapter 7. There was an initial historical application, but there was a latter-day application of the metals and the beasts as well. It's true of the little horn of chapter 7. There was an ancient application when the papacy first arose, but there is a special application at the time of the end. It's the same case with the little horn of the goat of chapter 8. We saw the history, but then we see at the time of the end, he rises up and stands up against the prince. And there is that special application, that future phase. In Daniel 9, there was a 400-year prophecy that went forth from the calling to rebuild Jerusalem till the Messiah being cut off, but then at the time of the end, there would be that special application in which the desolator himself would be cut off. In verse 36 to 39 is really we've looked at the rest of the latter-day prophecy in Daniel 11. We're just focusing now upon verses 36, 37, 38, and 39. And it speaks of a king in chapter 11 who will do according to his will. And even though it's only four verses, these four verses are very, very helpful in terms of supplementing what we've already seen in Daniel 7 about the beast and the little horn. And they are very helpful when we come to the book of Revelation and when we see the enormity of the role that the religious power plays in the time of the end. because Daniel 11 and these four verses are about two powers. It's the willful king and the strange god. Verse 36, the king shall do according to his will, and he shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak marvelous things against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished. For that is determined shall be done. Neither shall he regard the God of his fathers, nor the desire of women, nor regard any god, for he shall magnify himself above all. But in his estate shall he honor the God of forces, and the God whom his fathers knew not, shall he honor with gold and silver, and with precious stones and pleasant things. Thus shall he do in the most strongholds with a strange god, whom he shall acknowledge and increase with glory, and he shall cause them to rule over many, and shall divide the land for gain. So the first thing we want to notice in verse 36, it says he will do according to his will. It's actually one Hebrew word, ratzon, means to delight. He will do as he delights. It's not talking about his attitude. It's talking about his power. He will do whatever he wants to do because he has the power to do whatever he wants to do. There's three cross-references. You can look in at chapter 8, verse 4, chapter 11, verse 3, and chapter 11, 16, where it talks about none shall be able to stand before him. No beast might stand before him. He will do according to his will and become great. So it's not talking about his attitude. It's talking about his immense power. This is why Brother Thomas refers to him as the willful king. He can do whatever he wants, and no one can stop him. Again, the willful king is not a single person. It represents a kingdom, an empire, because this transverses hundreds and hundreds of years. It'll exist for 2,000 years because it will grow out of the king of the north. A Grecian king of the north is where verse 35 ends. And you see the Maccabean period mentioned in those concluding verses in chapter 11 from 30 to 35. And then out of that period would arise a power that God, in this case, chooses to represent as a willful king. You go through the details, and it's absolutely the Roman Empire, now with a new title, a new symbol. It corresponds to the two legs of the image in chapter 2, to the fourth beast of chapter 7, the little horn of the goat in chapter 8, the desolator in chapter 9. It's just one more symbol of the same power. Much of the focus of the visions and prophecies of Daniel around the Roman Empire, this is no exception. God uses a new symbol or a new title because there will be new details that emerge. But it's the same fourth beast power. In verse 35, the battles between the king and the north ends. The new power arises. And just as we saw with the little horn of the goat, remember, where did it come from? It came out of one of those four horns, and it went southward, southeastward, right to the Holy Land. That's exactly what happens. That's the same territory and the same power and the same time period that this willful king arises from. So with the fact that he rises in the same time in history and he comes from the same territory as the little horn of the goat, they must be the same power. And it shouldn't surprise us because once again, chapter 11 is an expansion on chapter 8. Chapter 11 will amplify things that weren't revealed in chapter 8. Another point to recognize is that chapter 8 was the vision, chapter 11 is the prophecy, but they're covering the same events. And the proof of that is in how each is, both chapter 8 and chapter 11 is constructed. We've shown the details on the screen. You'll be familiar with them. Both chapters, 8 and 11, begin with the Medes and Persians on the throne. And they both end with Christ on the throne. Chapter 11 describes the role of the Medes and the Persians, replaced by Alexander, replaced by the Roman Empire. Chapter 11 takes us through the same historical events. Chapter 8 covers the centuries of rule by the little horn of the goat, also known as the King of Fierce Countenance. Chapter 11 covers the same centuries. Only in this case, it's called a willful king. Chapter 8 ends how? With Jews dying. And then Christ destroying the little horn of the goat. Chapter 11 ends with Jews dying, and then Christ destroying the king of the north. Because at the time of the end, what Daniel is showing us is just how the willful king emerged out of that fourth horn, that king of the north horn. At the time of the end, it will merge back in to that king of the north horn. So in verse 36, the willful king emerges out of the little horn, out of the king of the north, and in verse 40, he will merge back in. And in both cases, in chapter 8 and chapter 11, the focus is on the time of the end. We're not going to trace through the details. Again, hopefully, we'll just mention a few things and it will help you to recall that it is a very powerful force, a very powerful, willful king that magnifies himself above all others. Where have we seen this before? The same description of the little king, the little horn of the goat, back in chapter 8 at verse 25. Only here's one of the new details. The little horn of the goat didn't really speak about religion in any detail, but the willful king prophecy does. Because in this period of time, there will be introduced a new religion that his fathers never knew. It corresponds, of course, historically to when Constantine decreed that Christianity would become the official religion, a religion that his fathers did not regard. The religious aspect wasn't revealed in chapter 8, but it is here in chapter 11. And this new religion will have a new god. It will have a strange god upon whom the willful king will heap honor and acknowledge and increase with glory and cause the strange god to rule over others and to divide the land of Israel for gain. If you're not aware, that word for strange is foreign. This new god would be a previously unknown god in the empire, unknown to the prior generations. The strange god, of course, being the papacy, because no other power fits the details revealed. The new religion was to promote a very strange and unique set of teaching. Celibacy would be a hallmark trait. The religious leader would be a god of forces. He would be a god of protectors, as the AV margin has. We won't take the time to go through it, but they would canonize dead men and women who would now become the protectors of this religion. Building and structures would play an important role in the religion, the most strongholds. We see that in the churches and the cathedrals. Two core values of this new religion: wealth and power to rule over people, is what verse 39 is telling us. Again, we move quickly, but only the Roman Catholic Church can answer to such a unique and unusual set of apostate teaching. But you notice what this prophecy is telling us, that there would be centuries in which this willful king and this strange god would work in close relationship. That's also reflected in the close working relationship between the emperor and the Roman Pope down through history. It mirrors what we saw in Daniel 7. This is not new information. The little horn with eyes and mouth that spoke great things came out of that fourth beast. And they had a close working relationship together when the little horn emerged. That same relationship exists at the time of the end, because the little horn is still speaking blasphemies, and the beast and the little horn are destroyed in chapter 7 at one and the same time. Here is another insight into that same relationship. There's a key phrase in verse 36 that shows or proves this prophecy has a latter-day application. And it's the phrase, "He shall prosper until when?" Until the indignation of God against Israel that we saw in chapter 8 shall be accomplished. It's the same indignation back in verse 19 of chapter 8. When God's indignation against Israel will end, so will end the rule of the willful king. And then Israel will enter a time of blessing. So what this means in verse 36, and I realize it's only a phrase, but sometimes that's all God gives us. How long will this end? How long will it continue? It will continue until the end of the indignation, until the indignation be accomplished. So that what verse 36 means is it will continue right through to the end. And it makes this then a latter-day prophecy, so that the willful king in chapter 11 is the same king of fierce countenance in chapter 8. It's the same desolator of Daniel 9. It's the same king of the north in verses 40 to 45. It's the same latter-day great adversary and enemy against Israel. And it will continue until Armageddon. And who will be working right alongside the willful king? the strange God with a strange religion. That's what this prophecy is telling us. Just as we saw in chapter 7, Daniel is saying, look for two powers at the time of the end to work as allies. One will be political, one will be religious, but they will be working for the same objective, the same end. And then when the willful king merges into the king of the north, its purpose will then be to go down and destroy Israel and take possession of the Holy Land. That is why we look for and can watch for a relationship to develop between the willful king and the strange God at the time of the end, because this prophecy tells us they will both still be there. Just as Daniel 7 tells us, they will both still be there. So that when we come to the false prophet and the dragon in Revelation, we should not be surprised that there is a political power, there is a military power, and there is a religious power working as allies, going off together to Armageddon. Because that wasn't invented, that wasn't begun in Revelation 16, it's all the way back here in Daniel 11, it was there back in Daniel 7. The same two powers. And God willing, we'll pick up with our study of Revelation in tomorrow's class.